All right. So welcome to the first instantiation of Javier Fernandez Galeano and my sort of work around this forthcoming issue of the Journal of Latin American Cultural Studies that we have. This is an issue forthcoming in 2022 with the title of Obscenity, Censorship, and Libidinal Politics in Latin America. And today what we are doing is sort of having a kind of podcast conversation between me and Javier around this upcoming Pandemonio JLACS conference that will take place on March 12th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. And this panel is titled Eroticized Bodies and Politicized Desires. And just very briefly for context, again, my name is Zeb Tortorici. I'm a historian of colonial Latin America by training, and I'm currently an associate professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese Languages and Literatures at New York University. And in the true spirit of the Journal of Latin American Cultural Studies, Javier and I are going to stage this conversation bilingually.
Hola, mi nombre es Javier Fernández Galeano. Soy historiador por formación, especializado en historia de la sexualidad del siglo XX en Argentina y España. Y en la actualidad tengo una beca postdoctoral Mellon en Wesleyan University. Y estoy encantado de tener esta conversación con Seth. Creo que vamos a empezar debatiendo el tema de por qué decidimos centrarnos en este concepto de la obscenidad y de las políticas libidinales. Y creo que Seth tiene unos puntos que aportar sobre cuál es la historia de esa definición, de ese término, y cuáles son los aportes que esa definición nos trae en el presente.
Perfect. So, thanks for that question, Javier. What I find particularly interesting about the term obscenity or obscenidad, are its historical, its shifting historical specificities. And what interests me, both in my own scholarship and research, but in the Pandemonio conference we're doing in a couple of weeks, and in terms of the special issue that we are curating for the Journal of Latin American Cultural Studies, are how certain bodies and certain desires historically come to be marked, labeled, or classified as obscene. And what I find particularly interesting is that this oftentimes has less to do with, say, the explicit or, quote unquote, excessive nature of the body or the desire or the act in and of itself, but rather with the individual who is doing that act, the person whose body or desires are being described, and the sort of politics that orients around the individual who has the power to mark, label, or classify certain acts or certain bodies or desires as being obscene. And given that I'm a historian of the colonial period, whose current research project is delving into the mid-20th century in Mexico and other parts of Latin America, for sort of a conceptual inspiration, I go back to the Real de Academia Española's 18th century Diccionario de Autoridades. And this was a multi-volume comprehensive dictionary, the first, comprehensive dictionary put forth by the Real Academia Española in the first half of the 18th century. And in Volume 5 from 1737, the Diccionario defines the term obsceno as impuro, sucio, torpe, y feo. So impure, dirty, shameless, and ugly. And I sort of love the analytical productivity that lurks behind this definition because of its slipperiness. And if we turn to the definition of the word torpe in that very same dictionary, we find that it is defined as deshonesto, impúdico, lascivo. Dishonest, shameless, or lascivious. What comes up, I think, in so much of my own research and scholarship, and will certainly come up in our conversation today, in the March 12th Pandemonio events, and in the special issue of JLACS that we're editing, are the ways that there is this sort of fluidity to what gets defined or termed as obscene, right? One person's erotica is another person's pornography. One person's trash is another person's treasures, et cetera. So again, I think going back to these 18th century and much earlier definitions, tying back to Latin terms that, etymologically refer to being off stage or what that which cannot be represented or portrayed, et cetera, I think opens up the conceptual and methodological realm for deeply analyzing and engaging this term. Your thoughts around that very same question, Javier, libidinal politics in particular.
Sí, a mí me parece que el concepto de obscenidad tiene como tantas vertientes y definiciones y manifestaciones que es en esa conexión entre las diferentes definiciones donde se abren caminos para explorar las relaciones de poder en la definición que has venido mencionando. Y yo pienso en la obscenidad en concreto como una forma de rechazo o de escándalo basado en términos o en definiciones hegemónicas de la moralidad que permite poner de manifiesto la relación entre violencia, sexualidad, regímenes coloniales, economías coloniales, etc. Por ejemplo, solemos decir que se puede producir una riqueza excesiva o otro tipo de fenómenos sociales relacionados con el poder que son obscenos. Y ahí es donde me parece que se pueden explorar las diferentes ramificaciones de la obscenidad entre la política y la intimidad de lo erótico, de lo sexual. Para mí el término políticas libidinales creo que emergió en parte de mi investigación, que tiene mucho que ver con estructuras de poder estatal, con los centros de construcción de esa narrativa nacional. En concreto estoy pensando en los archivos militares, que son como una de mis principales áreas de interés. Y para mí tuvo que ver con la forma en que al consumir o al contemplar esos materiales me sentía en una situación de consumidor pornográfico. O sea, no podía distinguir entre ir a un archivo nacional y la pornografía que se consume hoy en día en Internet en cierta forma, solo con la diferencia del formato de cómo se presentan esos testimonios o esas escenas. Y eso me hizo pensar en cómo en esas interacciones cotidianas entre diferentes agentes del Estado, en lo que se llama, según Marcos Cana, de historia social del Estado, que es desde bottom-up, desde lo más cotidiano o cercano al nivel de toma de decisiones más elevado, se ve cómo el Estado se va penetrando por esa sexualidad. O sea, el Estado no aparece como un ente puro, desexualizado, neutro, sino que es partícipe y está imbricado y atravesado por esas relaciones de poder erótico, que son las que a su vez constituyen las diferentes posicionalidades de los sujetos en la relación con el Estado. Y a la vez me interesa ver cómo la circulación de esos discursos a nivel tanto nacional como internacional va cambiando y modificando el significado del erótico, depende del contexto. Y eso es algo que queremos explorar con ese término de políticas libidinales.
Yeah, that's great. What I really like about your response is sort of thinking about the obscene and the erotic in terms of relationships of power in relation to the state. And this is a theme that our conversation will sort of swerve toward, I think, toward the tail end. I think your response also gets me thinking about sort of the slipperiness, obviously, between these categories of pornography, art, obscenity, and the erotic, which I think both of us see in our own individual research projects. And we certainly see in the presentations from the four scholars that we've invited to participate in Pandemonio, on March 12th. And also these are themes and kind of slippery kind of liminal categories that we explore in the special issue. So I'll pose another question here. You just, Javi, spoke a little bit about your own research, but I'm curious to hear a little bit more specifically, like what led you to the category of the obscene in terms of your own writing and this as an analytical and deeply politicized category?
Sí, estoy pensando, en primer lugar, agradecer a Gilax que nos diese la oportunidad de compartir ciertas imágenes que emergen de nuestra investigación. Tanto Seth como yo hemos colgado una serie de imágenes en la página web. Voy a hablar de las imágenes que emergen de mi investigación con números y así podéis consultarlas. El primer concepto, o sea, el primer ejemplo de esa noción de políticas libidinales sería esta entrevista, esta transcripción de una entrevista entre un fiscal y un acusado de actos contra actos deshonestos en 1977 en el ejército argentino. Y lo que me parece tan llamativo de esta entrevista es hasta qué punto hay un proceso de extracción de un testimonio hiperexplícito sobre ese encuentro sexual enfocado precisamente en la eyaculación y el semen, como actos que tienen que ver con la definición de la masculinidad. Esta entrevista en concreto tiene un punto humorístico porque cuando el fiscal preguntaba dónde salió, refiriéndose al semen, el acusado respondió al baño pensando que se refería a su compañero sexual y luego tuvieron que volver a aclarar eso hasta que finalmente el acusado aclaró que el semen había acabado en la boca de otro acusado. Y hay como ese testimonio oral que a su vez recrea una imagen muy visual de ese encuentro sexual que el oficial militar, siendo representante del Estado, está en cierta forma incitando y consumiendo. Y ahí es donde me parece que el Estado no se puede separar de los mecanismos de producción erótica u obscena. Este fue como mi inicio en la investigación de estas temáticas. Luego he ido recopilando diferentes tipos de repositorios. La imagen segunda procede de un archivo policial de Rosario, que ahora mismo está en el proceso de catalogación. Y aquí me retrotrae a nociones de la limpieza social que emergen del positivismo de principios del siglo XX, que también tienen la connotación de limpieza sexual. De nuevo, ¿qué comportamientos, qué tipo de corporalidades, de vestimenta, de representación del yo no pueden inscribirse en el espacio público sin ser considerados un acto que ofende contra la moral pública? En este caso fue una fiesta en la que había un grupo de asistentes tanto travestiéndose como usando ropas de origen exótico. Este hombre estaba llevando un kimono que se consideraba una ofensa contra la moral, en el sentido de que permitían articular formas alternativas de sociabilidad, de vestimenta, etc. Y luego, en un marco cronológico más cercano, la imagen tercera procede de un archivo particular de un coleccionista que se dedicaba a recortar imágenes de hombres de medios de prensa mayoritarios y reformularlas, reposicionarlas para recrear actos de encuentro homosexual. Y aquí me parece que es muy ilustrativo de la idea de que el obsceno puede emerger de un acto creativo de resignificación de materiales mayoritarios. En este caso, lo que hizo el coleccionista fue acompañar estas imágenes con un diálogo sexual, de una penetración anal. Uno de los hombres decía, ¿la sentís? Y el otro decía, sí, por Dios, no la metas más. Como era realmente el elemento oral lo que sexualizaba estas imágenes. Y esto me retrotrae también a la idea del activismo que emerge de la recuperación de materiales eróticos. Esta imagen en concreto es parte de un proyecto que vamos a llevar a cabo con Jorge Luis Peralta en la plataforma Moléculas Malecuas para visualizar estas formas alternativas de archivo. Y la última imagen es una imagen, en este caso de España, de una mujer trans que usaba la fotografía para plasmar y darle un estatus semipermanente a esa representación de su cuerpo, usando de nuevo la vestimenta, pero también el paisaje, como una forma de naturalizar esa feminidad entendida como una tecnología. Y lo que me parece interesante es que todas estas fotografías, de nuevo, eran confiscadas y archivadas en un archivo nacional, de forma que en una construcción del sujeto estigmatizado, indirectamente nos permiten activar esas imágenes para una narrativa alternativa de recuperación de las formas de parentesco y subjetividad de las comunidades trans y queer. Es algo que me parece que el obsceno nos abre un nuevo campo de exploración, pensar en cómo lo que se ha marcado como sucio, desagradable, etcétera, nos permite repensar los significados alternativos que se construyen dentro de esas comunidades marcadas como obscenas. Y aquí me interesa, he venido hablando del formato y de las formas de coleccionar estos materiales. Me parece que es algo que tú has venido explorando de una forma fascinante en tu trabajo, Seth, la forma de coleccionar y activar esos materiales.
Yeah, great. So I'll delve into my research real quick, but I want to turn back to one of the points that you raised, and again, in thinking about how obscenity gets linked to ideas about cleanliness and dirtiness, and going back to, you know, the point that I raised earlier about sort of those individuals who have the power to mark certain bodies or classify certain bodies as obscene, you know, oftentimes what we see, and I think you see this in your work, and I clearly see it in mine, is that those who get categorized or vilified as being obscene are clearly subjects that are marked in terms of other ways and characteristics and phenomena as well. And I'm thinking of bodies who are come to be marked by class, by sort of their colonial status, by social class. And we see this very clearly, you know, in a whole range of documents and records. So going back to this, you know, this question of what sort of led me to the obscene as an analytical and methodological category in my own work. You know, my first book project was on the sins against nature, or the so-called pecados contra natura, of sodomy, bestiality, and masturbation in colonial Mexico, or you know, sort of better categorized as La Nueva España, sort of the New Spain, which included the Philippines, included parts of what are today's Southwest United States, down through Central America. And this was a project that, you know, I was not looking for obscenity in any sort of sense of the word when I started this research project. But if I sort of direct our podcast listeners to the first image that I have shared, this is an image taken from one folio of a 1773 Inquisition trial against an individual named Manuel de Arroyo, who was a racially marked mulatto man who got roped up into the Holy Office of the Mexican Inquisition, essentially for having declared that it is no es pecado chupar el semen humano de otra persona. So eventually he's tied into the, he gets pulled into the Inquisition and put on trial for having declared that it is not a sin to suck human semen from another human being. And what's so fascinating about this case for me is that Arroyo is not on trial by the Inquisition for having committed the act of fellatio or for having engaged in sexual acts with another man, but rather for having declared that these things are sinful and for having disseminated and spread that heretical information. So if you look at the image here, you sort of see it reads basically, este tribunal, the tribunal of the Inquisition, donde debe ser castigado dicho reo con la gravedad correspondiente a sus obscenidades y temerarias persuasiones, right? So this suspect who should be punished for the gravities associated with his obscenities and his sort of reckless persuasions and discourse. And I love this image because this is one of the earliest images that got me thinking about the historical specificities of what gets marked and defined as obscene and how definitions of the obscene depend oftentimes so much on modes of transmission. So here we're looking at 18th century criminal and Inquisition trials in which the term obscenity comes up again and again and again in ways that criminally and racially mark the subjects whose bodies, desires, and acts are being seen as obscene by criminal authorities or by the Holy Office of the Inquisition. But it was sort of this kind of checkered appearance of obscenidad in my larger corpus of sodomy and bestiality trials for the colonial period that really got me thinking about the present and about how obscenity does and does not come to be archived and how it does and doesn't show up in particular archival collections. So this leads me to my current research project, which is tentatively titled Archiving the Obscene, Censorship, Pornography, and Erotica in Latin America. And this is really a sort of large project, multidisciplinary project with a digital archive component that seeks to shed light on the understudied connections between flea markets, private collections, museum exhibits, and archives in Mexico, as well as other parts of Latin America, asking how and why in terms of archival processing and technological change and innovation, so-called obscene representations of particular bodies do or do not come to be archived across diverse media, including late colonial criminal and inquisition trials, 19th and 20th century photography, and early 20th century film reels, leading us up into the present through VHS, video cassettes, and other digital file, not other, but and digital files, you know, through digital archiving. And what has kind of stood out to me in terms of this research project lead me to my final three images that I want to share. The second image is one of the fascinatingly few instances where the Archivo General de la Nación in Mexico, Mexico's National Historical Archives, preserve historical pornography and rare examples of historical erotica. And this is just a title page of a Spanish book dealer who moved to Mexico in the early 1900s and who gets roped into the law and put on trial again and again and again and again, you know, nearly a dozen times over the first few decades of the 20th century. And his name is Amadeo Perez. It's, you know, I don't have time to go into the fascinating contours and details of his criminal trials, but I love this particular image that I share, which you can see memorandum is the sort of first word, because of the juxtaposition of criminal text, the sort of portada or title page of this criminal trial or inquest, and the magazine that Amadeo Perez produced in and out of his bookshop titled Forma, which is a sort of artistic magazine for a male audience. And in this image, you really get this kind of fascinating juxtaposition of flesh and text, the criminal components of this archive and the sort of affective and artistic components of the images that pulled him in and drew him into criminal authorities in the very first place. And I just picked this image because, again, I mentioned this is one of the few images, one of the few instances in which the National Archives in Mexico preserve historical erotica, not toward the goal of preserving erotica, but rather because it was confiscated as evidence in 1937 and by chance comes to be preserved in the National Archives in Mexico. So much of this research project, current research project of mine, orients around the very checkered presence of historical pornography and erotica in mainstream historical archives and in hemerotecas nacionales. And this has really led me to rare bookshops and to flea markets, including this massive Sunday Mexico City antiques market at La Lagunilla in just north of downtown Mexico City. And this is really what I share with image in image number three. So this is an image that I took in 2016 of historical, you know, objects and kitsch being sold at this market. I remember, you know, years ago, I started speaking to antiques vendors about this project, you know, thinking about the preservation of historical erotica. And I thought that this particular dealer with whom I spoke, you know, he sort of lit up when I mentioned this project to him. And he basically told me, pues, yo sé que estás buscando. And I thought that he, like so many other antiques dealers with whom I had spoken, would invite me back a week or two or three weeks later and to share with me a little, you know, una cajita of preserved postcards or photographs, magazines, et cetera. And instead, he directed me to this 8mm film reel that you see at the bottom right hand of this image. And this, you know, he asked me to look at it with a magnifying glass in the sunlight, and I could see that this was an amateur erotic film or a pornographic film involving two women and a man, you know, given the fact that it's an 8mm and the fashion and styling of the images themselves, it's from the late 1960s, early 1970s. But long story short, I purchased this film reel, not for my own collections, but rather to donate to the Filmoteca de la UNAM, which is one of the largest film archives in Latin America, based out of the National Autonomous University of Mexico in, you know, southern part of Mexico City. And archivists there were with whom I had previously worked with their silent black and white pornographic film collections from Cuba, Argentina, and Mexico, were thrilled to sort of receive this donation. So this is, you know, the fourth and final image that I share is of Mario Tovar, one of the film preservation specialists at the Filmoteca, actually working on and splicing and editing damaged frames from that film reel I had donated back in 2016 or 2017. And I love this image because it sort of speaks to the collaborative processes and networks that we ourselves get involved with and engage in order to push forth the historical preservation of otherwise marginalized records, images, films, etc. So this whole larger project, it really does focus on obscenity and does so in a way that I think is collaborative and deeply activist, both with mainstream archives like the Archivo General de la Nación, sort of smaller state archives, film archives, El Centro de la Imagen, but also with grassroots historical archives. And the final thing I'll mention here before we move on to our next topic is that so much of my current collaborative research is around grassroots archiving and artistic exhibitions around historical erotica. So I just want to direct our listeners to the website elinsulto.com, El Insulto. And this is a grassroots arts collective and platform and digital and physical archiving project known as Archivo El Insulto, based out of Mexico City, that has just done phenomenal work around the collecting of and exhibition of historical erotica, sort of seeking not simply to archive, you know, the types of photographs and magazines and postcards that we find at flea markets and other places, but rather to reactivate them through artistic, through art exhibits and presentations, and really kind of bringing to life historical erotica in ways that reactivate the politics of the present, always in relation to historical understanding of desire in the past. So I'm sorry, as I'm wont to do, I went on a little bit too long there. But I think this kind of nicely leads us into the third theme, which is what types of scholarship has most inspired us in terms of thinking about obscenity in the history of erotica and the history of pornography. So, I pose this question to you, Javi.
Sí, creo que para mí una de las primeras obras que siempre vienen a la mente es una recopilación que se llama Porn Archives, que el editor se llama Tim Dean, que traza, o sea, recopila diferentes trabajos que se centran en esa conexión entre arte y obscenidad, activismo, y la introducción en concreto traza la genealogía del concepto de archivo aplicado al obsceno, y el argumento principal es que tanto el archivo como la pornografía emergen de forma simbiótica, de forma interdependiente en el periodo de la modernidad. En concreto, el ejemplo que usa el autor es el archivo, el Museo Borbónico y los artefactos y estatuas de contenido erótico que se recuperaron en Pompeya y cómo fueron excluidos a una habitación concreta. Y ese acto de archivo, ese acto de exclusión del público es lo que genera la definición de pornografía. Me pareció muy interesante esa noción de cómo las dinámicas de acceso, exclusión, más que la cualidad intrínseca del objeto, es lo que define la potencia de la obscenidad para presentar formas alternativas de entender la sexualidad. Otro libro que para mí fue muy influyente fue Cultures of the Erotic, de Maite Zubiaurre, que traza como va recopilando de nuevo en colaboración con coleccionistas, con bibliotecas de segunda librerías de segunda mano, mercadillos, etcétera, va recopilando postales eróticas de finales del 19, principios del 20 en España, que muestran cómo iconografías asociadas al nacionalismo, al colonialismo, etcétera, adquieren un significado diferente cuando son parte del repertorio simbólico que expresa la promiscuidad o la aceptación de la promiscuidad erótica entre sectores populares, según el argumento de la autora. Y usa como imágenes postales de miembros del clero en posturas comprometidas, etcétera, para mostrar esa sexualización de las imágenes de poder, de imágenes del nacionalismo, que me parece que es muy interesante en el contexto que venimos usando este concepto. Por último, hay un libro de Thomas Vogt que se llama Hard to Imagine, que traza las diferentes coartadas a través de las cuales las comunidades queer eran capaces de consumir erótica sin llamar la atención de las autoridades, y utiliza tres conceptos en concreto: el arte, el deporte y el naturismo. Y son nociones que muestran la importancia de lo estético y de los mecanismos de distribución y consumo en permitir la experiencia erótica en relación con materiales visuales y de otro tipo. Entonces me parece que estas tres obras conjuntamente muestran como la diversidad de las formas de producción de lo pornográfico u obsceno y su relación con los diferentes mecanismos demarcado de cuerpos diferentes que venimos exponiendo en esta presentación. Y ahí me parece que también tiene que ver mucho con tu trabajo.
Thank you so much. And I think if I were to answer, you know, if I'm answering the same question, I would go back essentially to kind of studies of early modern representations of pornography and the erotic. I'm thinking of Lynn Hunt's sort of watershed 1993 book, The Invention of Pornography, 1500 to 1800, Obscenity and the Origins of Modernity. And this is a book for me that again, you know, does phenomenal work in terms of the historical specificities and analytical productivity of the category of obscenity. This ties in beautifully with a book that was edited, co-edited by Nick Jones and Chad Leahy last year, edited by, published by Rutledge, called Pornographic Sensibilities, Imagining Sex and the Visceral in Pre-Modern and Early Modern Spanish Cultural Production. I loved in your response, Javier, looking at Maite Subiaurre's work, the question of the church and clerics in relation to the production and circulation of erotic and pornography. And you know, with my current research project, sort of tying the 18th century up to the present, what I see when I look at Inquisition trials from the 18th century, oftentimes are Catholic priests getting in trouble for having, you know, alms boxes that have, you know, you open up the top and there's like two people having sex, or a priest that has a statue that looks like a saint on, you know, if it's held in one way and turns into, you know, a penis if held the other way. So it's, you know, again, the role of the church and the clerics in terms of the production and circulation and hiding and obfuscation of pornography, I think is something that we see in so much of the scholarship on early modern pornographic productions and sensibilities. And the final two, two or three fields that I would focus on are works that engage questions of colonialism, coloniality, and pornography. I'm thinking in particular of Lisa Siegel's book, Governing Pleasures, Pornography and Social Change in England, 1815 to 1914, which has a phenomenal chapter looking at British colonialism, especially in Anglophone Africa, colonial British Africa, and the ways that Blackness comes to be violently circumscribed in erotic postcards and pornographic postcards, and how these things circulate throughout Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century. Also thinking about Anjalia Rondekar's book, For the Record, on Sexuality in the Colonial Archive in India, which has a phenomenal chapter on the history of the India rubber dildo, and thinking about representations and the commodification both of Indian rubber, you know, in the Americas, but sort of filtered through, you know, Victorian pornography and later 20th century pornography, you know, by and through, you know, British colonial India. A third field that I've been absolutely inspired by comes out of Black feminist theory and praxis. And I'm thinking particularly of Mireille Miller Young's A Taste for Brown Sugar, Black Women in Pornography, and Jennifer Nash's recent book, The Black Body and Ecstasy, Reading Race, Reading Pornography. And both of these works, I think, do phenomenal job of grounding Black feminism in pornographic production and critique of that very production, you know, leading us back to the late 19th, early 20th century. And a final kind of field, I think, would be largely the historiography and cultural studies scholarship coming out of Mexico and other parts of Latin America. I'm thinking of Ángel Níquel's, you know, edited volume, Placeres en Imagen, Fotografía y Cine Eróticos from 1900-1960, which has been a sort of foundational work for scholars in visual studies and history and film studies working on the erotic. And Juan Gabriel Solís's 2015 doctoral dissertation, El Cuerpo del Delito, Los Delitos del Cuerpo, La Colección de Cine Pornográfico Callado de la Filmoteca de la UNAM. And this is a doctoral dissertation that focuses exactly on that corpus of erotic film being preserved at the Filmoteca de la UNAM, which is the very same archive that I reached out to and donated that 1960s, 1970s, film for their collections. And You know, I think for both of us, these bodies of scholarship have been so key in orienting both our own individual individual research projects, and also in terms of thinking collaboratively about both the Pandemonio Conference and this edited volume that we are co-editing for the Journal of Latin American Cultural Studies. So that really just leads me into our final topic for conversation now is, what do we hope this special issue will accomplish, and how do we see it as conversing with, a range of interdisciplinary fields and research methods and methodologies?
Sí, en ese sentido creo que algo que hemos percibido desde el principio, desde que publicamos la llamada a propuestas, ha sido un gran interés por el special issue, que tiene mucho que ver con, por un lado, el contexto actual político de una reacción muy conservadora ante la idea de discutir públicamente temas de diversidad sexual o de empoderamiento femenino, de construccionismo del género, etcétera. ¿Cómo ese ambiente de reacción conservadora provoca que a nivel de la academia se incite, se reactive el interés en cómo la obscenidad problematiza, socava las narrativas monumentales sobre el Estado o sexualiza el colonialismo y los legados del colonialismo de una forma que permite abrir nuevos debates sobre la relación entre activismo y obscenidad? También hemos apreciado un interés en la corporalidad y los significados del cuerpo en el activismo, en particular por ejemplo, en el tema del activismo trans, el activismo LGTB. Y también hemos notado un fuerte interés en la conexión entre circuitos globales de circulación de materiales pornográficos o eróticos y debates a nivel local sobre el significado político de esa circulación, pero también sobre, dentro de los círculos intelectuales, el significado de la contracultura. O sea, que hay diferentes ejes que nos permiten trazar conversaciones entre intervenciones multidisciplinares, desde performance studies o estudios de la performance, estudios de la pospornografía, estudios históricos, de estudios literarios, etcétera, dependiendo del formato en el que se centran los diferentes autores. Y en esta misma línea hemos querido organizar el panel del día 12 de marzo, teniendo en cuenta o invitando autores que utilizan diferentes formatos, diferentes enfoques disciplinarios para acercarse a la cuestión de la obscenidad. Vamos a hablar un poco sobre el formato de esa charla. Los partícipes serán cuatro, todos los cuales han compartido una serie de materiales audiovisuales o literarios en la página de GILAX para que los asistentes al evento puedan, con anticipación, familiarizarse con esos materiales y ver hacia dónde se dirige la conversación. Voy a presentar en primer lugar dos de los ponentes, que serían María Celeri, cuyo trabajo se titula Bésame por favor, el uso de la obscenidad para denunciar la violencia a los incontables, que es una obra del EMBL que ha compartido un formato PDF en la página, de forma que podáis leerla con anticipación. En segundo lugar, tenemos a Robert Franco, que va a centrarse con el título, bueno, lo traduzco al español, pero en inglés sería Revolutionary Rumors, Obscenity Censorship and the Bisexual Erasure of Emiliano Zapata, Rumores Revolucionarios, Obscenidad, Censura y el Borrado Bisexual de Emiliano Zapata, que se centra en esta idea de la controversia que suscitó la sexualización con una tonalidad queer de la imagen de Zapata y que también ha compartido imágenes en la página. Seb va a presentar los últimos ponentes.
Yeah, great. So the final two speakers that we've invited on March 12th are both working in sort of the broad field of cultural studies and performance studies. The first is Ines Oedraogo, who is working on a fascinating sort of performance collective known as Fuck the Fascism. And this is a paper that looks at Chilean performance artist Maria Basurra's revenge on European colonialism by and through sort of desecrations, corporeal desecrations of the monuments and statues and physical records and instantiations that celebrate colonialism globally. And our final presenter is Irina Troconis, who is presenting a paper titled French Kissing the Idol, Erotic Iconoclash, and Political Subversion in Deborah Castillo's The Emancipatory Kiss, which really looks at kind of the moral outrage that sort of was sparked by and through this performance piece, looking at kind of erotics with you know, the great liberator of Latin America, Simón Bolívar. And you know, I think these four papers, what they show and do is show us in some ways how there's always a mutually productive and almost co-constitutive relationship between censorship and the obscene. So I think for both Javier and myself, as well as for our contributors and those, you know, in the future, thinking toward the special issue that we're working toward for Journal of Latin American Cultural Studies, you know, rather than us see censorship as simply a repressive mechanism, we, you know, in a sort of queer methodological way, we see censorship as rupturing binaries and very much producing and conditioning and eroticizing the erotic. So I'll steal a sentence from Javier here that we put in the call for papers, but he writes, censorship thus implies the production of the erotic as its inverse reflection and as the very precondition for the existence and enticement of the erotic. And I think really this is what this larger project is trying to do, thinking about obscenity, its cultural contours, historical specificities, in terms of its deep analytical productivity that allows us to you know, break down in many ways disciplinary boundaries by and through, you know, as Javier pointed out, performance studies, literature, film studies, visual studies, colonial studies, et cetera. And in ways that, again, I think rupture binaries between official archives and unofficial archives, between, you know, between artistic, the erotic, and the pornographic, and between repression and, you know, production, tolerance, acceptance, on the other hand. So with that, I think, you know, 40 minutes in, we probably need to conclude our conversation. So we thank those of you who listened, you know, to this conversation between the two of us. And again, we just direct everybody to check out the rest of the website, and especially the multimedia components that our four contributors have uploaded before the March 12th event. And a final word about format is that the first half of that March 12th event will be dedicated to our four presenters presenting their own research and scholarship. And the second half will be a sort of engaged conversation with the audience and amongst the six of us. So thank you so much for listening, and we hope to see you on March 12th.
Muchas gracias. Al día 12, un saludo.
Bye.
Bye.
Please stop.